to the fourth case of the day, the United States v. Hearn.
Push it in. Morning. May it please the court. My name is Shane Bruner. I represent the defendant, Robert Hearn. Mr. Hearn is appealing his conviction for possession and for possession and intent to distribute crack cocaine. This court should reverse Mr. Hearn's conviction and remand for a new trial and resentencing for two primary reasons. First, the district court erred under Rule of Evidence 403 and 404B when it admitted substantial evidence of Mr. Hearn's prior acts that the government then used to argue Mr. Hearn's propensity to commit the charged offense. Second, the government failed to prove that the drugs in question were crack cocaine. Its own chemist refused to identify the drugs as crack cocaine, and its other witnesses gave conclusory opinions, which were insufficient. Turning to the first issue, this case is about whether Robert Hearn possessed crack cocaine on the night of March 24, 2006. The government's only evidence on this point is the testimony of one police officer who claims to have seen him drop a bag. Mr. Hearn's defense in this case was simply that he didn't possess the drugs in question. He never said, if I possessed them, I didn't intend to distribute them. He simply said he did not possess the drugs. So in light of this meager evidence, what the government offered at trial was testimony of five witnesses to testify exclusively to facts of prior acts of Mr. Hearn's activities in the past relating to drugs. For example, the government offered the testimony of three police officers and a state chemist to testify in great detail about Mr. Hearn's 2003 conviction for manufacture and distribution of crack cocaine. They didn't testify anything about the present offense. Further, they offered the testimony of Agent Giovanelli, who spoke with Mr. Hearn during a cooperation agreement regarding the present offense. Agent Giovanelli's testimony was exclusively about Mr. Hearn's history of selling drugs. He testified about that Mr. Hearn had been selling, that Mr. Hearn told him he'd been selling drugs since 1997, who his suppliers were, who his customers, the regularity with which he dealt. However, importantly, Agent Giovanelli admitted that during this cooperation agreement, never once did they discuss the present offense. Now, the government argues in this case that these prior acts were relevant to show intent, lack of mistake, knowledge, every other exception that's identified in Rule 404B. But the true purpose of this evidence was revealed in closing argument. At closing argument, the government stated, I quote, "This case is about a drug dealer who was once again caught on March 24, 2006. This argument looks and sounds exactly like the once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer argument that is impermissible under Rule 404B. Now, the government relies on U.S. versus Curry to support its position that it could be allowed for intent. But when you look closely at Curry, there's a big difference. That difference is, in Curry, three witnesses testified that the defendant sold drugs at this time of the day, at this place. He packaged his drugs in a particular way. These were all distinguishing similarities with the charged offense in Curry. This evidence goes to Curry's modus operandi, his plan, his common scheme. The important difference with Mr. Hearn is that his prior acts evidence provided no distinguishing similarities. There was nothing alike other than the fact that in the past he had sold cocaine, he was charged and convicted with selling cocaine, and in this case, he was claimed to have cocaine in his possession.
Can I stop you because there's not much time and I need something answered. Can you explain the timeline of the evidentiary ruling? It seems the district court decided to allow evidence about the proffer and other crimes because Mr. Hearn indicated he was going to testify contrary to that evidence. But you seem to argue that Hearn was forced to testify about the proffer and his other crimes because the court had already decided this evidence was admissible.
Yes, Your Honor. The way that it transpired is the government provided notice that it was going to use evidence of the cooperation meeting. At that point, Mr. Hearn filed a motion in limine asking that that evidence be kept out. The court then ordered, the court was under the misapprehension at the time that Mr. Hearn had testified that about the current offense to, or not testified, had made statements about the current offense to Agent Giovanelli during the cooperation agreement. Because of the court's misapprehension, the court stated, if Mr. Hearn testifies, if he takes the stand and denies he committed the charged offense, then I'm going to let in all the other statements he made. The problem was he never talked to Agent Giovanelli about the present offense. So the court was wrong to assume that that was the case. And Agent Giovanelli testified in cross-examination that they never talked about the present offense. So Mr. Hearn had made the strategic decision at that point that he was going to testify and deny that the drugs were in his possession. At that point, he had to play the hand he was dealt, and to some extent, he went ahead and testified about the cooperation meeting himself. But the motion in limine had already been decided, and he had to deal with what he had.
Now, he never told the officers the cocaine was his because they never asked him.
Correct.
And so when he later testified he wasn't guilty, that the cocaine wasn't his that testimony isn't directly contrary to what he said in the proffer.
Absolutely.
He did admit he'd been dealing drugs ever since he got out of prison, but he didn't concede that the drugs found next to him on the night in question were his.
Correct.
Correct. So, didn't he open the door to a lot of the testimony himself? Because his statement during the proffer that he'd been dealing drugs up until his arrest, and his concession during his direct testimony that he exaggerated during the proffer, doesn't that make the rest of the proffer admissible?
Your Honor, at this point, the motion in limine had been decided that if Mr. Hearn denied that he committed the offense, then all the evidence during the cooperation agreement would come in. And all he said on direct examination was that he exaggerated what he told the government. There was nothing that came in through his cross-examination or Agent Giovanelli that directly contradicted anything that he said during his statement. It wasn't proper to use for impeachment evidence in this case. The motion in limine had been granted, and Mr. Hearn had to proceed under that guidance.
Mr. Brunner, I want to direct your attention, if I could, to the opening statement.
Yes.
Now, in the opening statement, of which we only have fragments, we don't have in the appendix, briefs. In the opening statements, what did counsel say Hearn was denying? Was he denying that the drugs were his, or were they denying that they were drugs? How did he frame it?
My recollection of defense counsel's statements was that the drugs in question were not in Mr. Hearn's possession. He was not denying that the bag was something other than drugs, like sugar or something like that.
So he didn't deny that they were drugs?
He did not.
I mean, that's what counsel said in opening statement, right? That he
that, wasn't. That's how I understand it. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is there a Kimbrough issue here? Was it preserved, if there is?
Well, the Kimbrough issue was raised at sentencing by Mr. Hearn.
Yeah, I know.
And then again, it was raised here. I think the effect of Kimbrough in this case is that the Supreme Court really confirmed that there's this that crack and cocaine is really a distinction without a difference, and it is proper for a court in its discretion to go below the guideline, the sentencing guidelines for crack. In this case, we believe that the judge may have, in her discretion, lowered Mr. Hearn's sentence had she had the guidance of Kimbrough.
So, do you think additional briefing would be appropriate here?
I think additional briefing would explain the issue and flesh it out better, since Kimbrough has issued recently. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Spooner.
Thank you.
Good morning again. Additional briefing, Your Honor, may be appropriate in this case. Of course, this is a career offender case, so to the extent that Kimbrough plays any role, it only plays it on the statutory consideration. I mean, this is not a case in which the drug quantity is determined by the drug, or the drug quantity directs the offense level. It's directed by the statutory provisions.
The court said at one point that the other crime's evidence was admissible to show knowledge, intent, lack of mistake, whether or not Hearn testified. How were any of those factors at issue unless Hearn testified? He didn't claim he did not know the substance was cocaine, or that he was mistaken about the substance, or that he did not intend to sell it. And until the court found all of the other crimes evidence admissible, his defense was that it was not his cocaine. At that point, the other crimes evidence shows nothing but propensity. Wasn't he more or less forced into giving his testimony by the court's decision to admit the other crimes evidence?
I don't think at all.
No?
No. I would hope you follow through this chronologically. The 404B decision was made pre-trial and related exclusively to the 2003 incident, his arrest and conviction in 2003 when he sold crack cocaine, and the undercover agents then found the $30. I'm sorry, they weren't undercover agents. The Springfield police officers found the $30 that was used in the undercover purchase on him at the time of his arrest. That was the pre-trial 404B ruling, that single incident, and that came in to prove Mr. Hearn's intent. Now, you indicated, and I hope I can address Judge Flom's question, killing two birds with one stone. In opening statement, the defense counsel said on page 154, beginning on page 154 of the transcript, now 5 grams is not much. The evidence will show that this is a very small amount of drugs, and that brings into play the second element. The government has promised to prove that this amount of drugs was possessed with the intent to distribute. Next page. And I'll ask you to listen to that officer's testimony to say whether, with that small amount of drugs, whether that could be used for personal use or for distribution, or whether you might have some doubts on that. So the premise of the argument by defense counsel in this case appears to be that unless Mr. Hearn himself spoke those words, that it can't bring intent into an issue in the case. His claim is that, well, all we do is put the government to its burden, but it would be absurd for a defendant to testify, well, I never possessed these drugs, but if I did, I didn't intend to distribute them. That's the kind of argument the defense counsel makes. And Judge Flom, in response to your question, I will read on the same page that I'm on, 155. You have to go back. The first issue he raises, this is an opening statement, he does them in a different order in closing argument, but the first issue is whether or not this is crack cocaine. He announces that to the jury, and I don't recall whether it's in the appendix or not, but it's in his opening statement. Follows through with this very same arguments in closing argument, and you realize this is echoed a little bit in the testimony of Mr. Hearn about the little itty-bitty amount, and he says it could have been used in cross-examination of the government's expert. Could this be a user quantity? So that was sort of a theme that or undercurrent that ran throughout the trial. And then in closing argument, the third issue, the third element the government has to prove, whether the defendant had the intent to distribute this evidence to somebody else is the issue. As to whether the government has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that this was intended for distribution, Officer Haas gave his opinion. And his opinion was that it was for distribution. But was that enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was for distribution? So this is really a classic case in which intent comes into play and 404B evidence proving intent is appropriate because the defendant himself is putting intent at issue. The government's position is not because this was a specific intent crime, therefore open the floodgates to 404B evidence. That wasn't it at all. And by the way, I think that you probably know from experience, there are some cases in which you pretty much know the defendant is going to take the witness stand. And this is, I think if you look at the pretrial pleadings and opening statement for sure, it's abundantly clear that this defendant was going to take the witness stand. And Judge Rovner, I mean this respectfully, I don't see that he was forced to take the witness stand in any way, shape, or form by the judge's order. The judge's order was, look, if he takes a position contrary to his proffer to the agents, then in accordance with the terms of that cooperation agreement, the government can use that evidence in its case in chief. But it didn't. That didn't happen. It was only once Mr. Hearn took the witness stand and testified contrary to what he told the agents. And one perfect example is he said, well, yeah, I told them that I dealt drugs right up until the day that I was arrested in this case. I'd been dealing drugs. I started dealing drugs a month after I got out of prison. I dealt with these two guys until the day I got out. And he said, no. That was an exaggeration. Well, that's pretty contrary to what his cooperation agreement was. He was expected to tell the truth. And so as soon as he admitted on the witness stand, I essentially lied, or I exaggerated, to use his term. Then it was perfect.
Well, you know, it's a chicken and egg problem. The district court said the proffer and convictions were admissible if he testified he wasn't guilty. He claims he talked about the proffer and denied his guilt because the court had already decided to admit other crimes evidence. So,
you know, I need to
she found, you know, that the 99 and 2003 drug convictions could be used to impeach his new claim that he lied when he told the prosecutor he'd been dealing crack since 97 or whenever it was. And then the prosecutor indicated, you know, that he wished to admit the details underlying those convictions. And Judge Scott then commented that the details were only incrementally prejudicial once the conviction itself had been admitted. And she also found that whether or not he testified, the 2003 drug conviction was admissible to show, you know, knowledge, intent, lack of mistake. But that would be correct only if knowledge, intent, and lack of mistake are at issue. And all of that depends on his defense. If he argues that the government failed to prove its case, none of that evidence should have come in because it would be pure propensity evidence. And he said that he intended to argue that the drugs that were found next to him weren't his. But, and that defense wouldn't raise an issue regarding knowledge, intent, or lack of mistake. He's not saying that he didn't know the substance was cocaine or that he was mistaken, you know, or intending to sell. He's merely stating that the drugs belonged to someone else. So do you see where I'm having a problem?
I see where you're having a problem, and I feel your frustration here, but I urge you to look at the opening statement and the closing argument.
Uh-huh.
You are sort of cabining his defense into Mr. Hearn's testimony, which was, I didn't possess this stuff. I just happened to be there. That was not the defense that was presented at trial. That was not the statement that I just read from opening statement, and we could repeat the same thing from closing argument. His defense was threefold. One, I didn't possess this particular drugs. Two, If I possessed it, it was a user amount. It was for personal use. It wasn't a distribution amount. And three, if it was a distribution amount, it wasn't crack cocaine.
Mr. Hart, sir. If he had limited it to, they're not my drugs, if the defense had framed it just that way, which I appreciate your responding to my inquiry to your colleague, if he had framed it, could it have come in then? If he limited, if in both opening statement, they're just not my drugs, could the other evidence, 403 evidence, come in?
I think it comes, that brings up Curry. That's an innocent bystander defense where intent becomes an issue. So,
because I appreciate the argument of whether Curry applies or not, but that would be a tougher case, it seems to me. But you're saying that didn't occur here because they framed it in the alternative. It's not my drugs.
That's very fair. That would be a tougher case. That's a very good point. This should not be a tough case, Judge Rovner, because of what they stated in their opening and closing.
Okay. Now, Mr. Harster, was he forced into framing it because of the earlier ruling?
I don't see that at all. I see the earlier ruling, and I believe it's attached in the appendix, to be if he takes a position contrary to what he said in the proffer, then the statements can come in. Not exclusively if he denies guilt, the statements are going to come in. So I would urge you to read the pretrial ruling on that particular point.
If I thought that the court ruled that it would allow evidence from the proffer only if Hearn took the stand and denied his guilt, I would be wrong?
I'm not prepared to say you're wrong because I don't have in front of me that ruling, but I thought that the judge ruled that if he takes a position contrary to what was in the proffer, that the proffer statement would come in. And she cautioned counsel to be careful in opening statement to not open the door. So I cannot tell you, Judge Rodman, if you're wrong. I need to go back and read
Yeah, I do too.
But I thought the provisions of the proffer are, if he takes a position contrary to what he says in the proffer, then it becomes admissible as substantive evidence. I ran out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd love to say more.
Mr. Hartson. Ms. Bruner, I think your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute.
Thanks. Pardon me.
I'd like to make just two quick points. One is, after the pretrial motion in limine, the decisions and the arguments made by defense counsel in opening argument and closing argument, he had to play the hand he was dealt at that point.
You're saying it's preordained by the ruling.
Exactly.
So what's wrong with the ruling, though, initially? The judge's ruling again. I think you said it was based on a misperception.
Well, here it is, and here's the exact quote from the judge's ruling on the cooperation meeting statements. The district court said, I quote, if the defendant takes the stand and testifies and denies he committed the offense with which he's charged, the government can introduce his proffer both with respect to what he said in the proffer concerning the current charges and what he said in the proffer related to drugs, and other drug incidents. So the judge made clear, if you deny the drugs are yours, this is all coming in. At that point, the defense had to take...
What is the error there?
The error is that he never testified. One, he never testified... Or he never made any statements during the cooperation meeting about the current offense. So if she was allowing, for whatever reason she was allowing this in, it certainly wasn't impeachment. It was exclusively prior acts evidence to show whatever purpose the government claimed that it was useful for.
And is that, in your view, because the agents who took the proffer made an enormous mistake? Because they assumed he was pleading guilty, they didn't ask him if he committed the charged conduct?
I don't know if that was a mistake or not. Maybe the agent didn't want to hear the real answer. But that was a decision that he made. He did not ask about the charges.
Well, he never told the officers the cocaine was his because they never asked him.
That's correct. Absolutely correct.
Well, one of the officers witnessed is testified in the case, right? That they saw what they believe happened, right?
One police officer said, "I saw Mr. Hearn toss an object."
So would he be asking him in the proffer whether they're yours? If he believes he saw that, what he
testified. I guess it all depends on what age of Giovanelli's interest in the cooperation agreement was.
I see. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, Bruner. Obviously, thanks to both counsel. Ms. Bruner, I want to extend an additional thanks to you and your firm and associate for accepting this assignment on appeal.
My pleasure.
All right. Case is under advisement, and the court.